Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and save $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up.
Known as one of the most far-sighted visionaries on the internet today. Luckily, they have corrective lenses for that stuff nowadays. He's Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense.
I'm just curious what Americans would do if we had here in the States a satirical political news magazine that pretty much lampooned everyone, but that, you know, took special pleasure, of course, in going after the top politician in the land in the situation we have here in the United States. That would be President Obama right now, wouldn't it? How would people in this country feel if that magazine drew caricatures of the president that were like 1930s style racist type cartoons? I mean, all the old stereotypes from the, you know, I don't have to go through them, do I? We all have stereotypes for different people. Yours truly, there are many stereotypes about me. I fit all those white man stereotypes, don't I? Nonetheless, do you think we'd put up with that for very long? What do you think would happen to an outlet like that? I'm just going to guess. I mean, look at how upset people get. And I'm not disagreeing with it. And I'm a Redskins fan, by the way, over the Washington Redskins. And the symbol for that football team. And by the way, I'm one of those people that thinks you don't choose mascots if you don't admire them. So most of the time, I'm all in on whatever they want to choose. Fighting Irish, you know. It can get very stereotypical to some of us people. But, you know, I'm not offended. I can live with that. But Redskins is kind of over the line. I mean, it's not fighting Cherokee. It's Redskins. Okay, I get it. But here's the thing. How do you think people who have a problem with that are going to deal with a news magazine that draws cartoons of the president that look racist, that plays up all the... I mean, come on, we're not... The reason I'm bringing this up is because there's a terrible tragedy that just happened in France since the last time we did this program involving 12 people being shot in the office of a satirical news magazine / newspaper. And all of us are standing up and touting our willingness to support things like free speech and free expression. And while I am all in with that sentiment, as you know, I believe we're all extremists on a few issues. I'm an extremist on this one. I think there's a place for all those kinds of things. And I think satire and political satire specifically is one of the main things that were actually what the framers of the Constitution had in mind when they drew up a First Amendment and freedom of speech and expression, or like the very first thing. They weren't thinking of your right to swear in a public place. They weren't thinking of your right to dance naked at an adult nude club. These things, though, have gone to court, and the defense has been freedom of expression. But what the founders specifically were trying to protect are the kind of things in that news magazine in France. And yet, if we had it here now, I'm pretty sure it goes out of business because organized groups get people to boycott the sponsors. Am I wrong? And let me put it another way. A lot of you who hadn't thought about it that way, if you think about it long enough, you'll see what I mean. In the minds of some of you folks, this wouldn't be allowed. And the funny part about it is, the more likely you are to be saying, I'm a huge defender of free expression, the more likely I bet you are to be upset about, you know, what a paper like, I think the name is Charlie Hebdo. And, you know, I mangle foreign languages generally in proportion to how beautiful they are. So French doesn't stand a chance. So my apologies to everyone. But if we had a satirical newspaper as cutting edge, as sharp as that one, as biting, as nasty, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could put it, as that one, how long do you think people in this country would put up with that? But that is free speech. You know, it's very easy to stand up for a platitude. It's a lot harder when you start getting specific. I mean, should the Nazis around us be allowed to use Twitter or Facebook or social networking, which, I mean, it's impossible to prevent them. But when you think about Nazis on Twitter, we'll go right over the Godwin's Law line right away, just to make a point. Do you think that's okay? Now, here in the United States, we've actually had court cases, you know, challenging and defending the right of Nazis to march. And by the way, they won. So in this country, we may come down one way on that issue. But in places like Germany, is it still, I think, Ben, it is still illegal, isn't it, to be proselytizing Nazism? The problem is in a globalized society where people have access to websites and Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff, what prevents German Nazi sympathizers or people who might be prone to having that, you know, side of their personality exploited, if converted by the right sort of charismatic person who advocates the philosophy, were to come into contact with that philosophy via Twitter and somebody of the Nazi-ish style persuasion in the United States using it? How do you prevent Nazis in the United States from infecting Nazis in Germany, even though there are laws to try to prevent the transmission of dangerous ideas like Nazism? We're in a very strange place, folks, as a free society dealing with people who have what we think are dangerous ideas. Our core values require free expression. And yet that also means free expression for the people who might propagate things that could create real-world realities that are horrible. If communism is some coffee house chat utopian political ideology and theory in the 1850s, that's one thing. If it takes a hold of a major country, you know, and in 1930, they're killing lots of people because of it, it's another. Dangerous ideas can turn into dangerous realities. In fact, there is no reality that comes into being without the ideas that lead up to it. What if the ideas are corrupt and dangerous and nasty and inhumane, you know, fill in the blank. But in a free society, there's an assumption built into, you know, the organization of this. And the assumption is that the competition of ideas is, you know, what it's all about. And that the ideas that are superior will win out. We do not fear Nazism and the transmission of Nazi ideas because we feel like in the marketplace of ideas, there's no way the Nazi idea is not getting, you know, eviscerated. We're not worried about it the way the Germans are worried about it, for obvious reasons. But during the Red Scare eras in the United States, during the Cold War, you better believe the transmission of radical ideas was something that the law was fighting and the intelligence services were fighting and that people got in trouble for. And you see it now, of course, with the people who would transmit, you know, terroristic ideas or support of causes that terrorists tend to back. I mean, Glenn Greenwald had a piece in The Intercept about a week ago, the paper that he started with other people, and it was about the people that are getting in trouble for going on Twitter and Facebook and all these websites, and not, you know, not going across the line where we can all say, well, what do you expect? Not saying something like bomb those buildings or do this or that, but those places that are in the weird zone. The devil's in the detail part of free speech always comes to the speech that's right on the line. If you're advocating via social media a specific attack against a person or thing, you're over that line. But what if you're not quite doing that? It starts to bleed into areas where more and more people become uncomfortable and say, well, wait a minute, that's something that a person shouldn't get in trouble for saying. I'll give you an example. In Greenwald's pieces, he has a couple of people in Britain who've gotten in trouble. And so Americans might be likely to say, well, you know, that's why the British deserve and need a constitution like ours so they can be protected from this kind of activity. But the tweets and whatnot, I got to get a little more specific for you here. Hold on. So here's an example of one of them, right? And it's from the beginning of the piece. And I should say, the piece is entitled, "With Power of Social Media Growing, Police Now Monitoring and Criminalizing Online Speech," by Greenwald. Appeared on The Intercept, I think the dateline on this is the 6th of January, 2015, from the beginning of the piece, quote, "On March 6, 2012, six British soldiers were killed in Afghanistan by a roadside explosive device, and a national ritual of mourning and rage ensued. Prime Minister David Cameron called it a, quote, desperately sad day for our country, end quote. A British teenager, Azhar Ahmed, observed the reaction for 2 days and then went to Facebook to angrily object that the innocent Afghans killed by British soldiers receive almost no attention from British media. He opined that the UK soldiers in Afghanistan are guilty, their deaths deserved, and are therefore going to hell. Here is the Facebook quote as posted by Greenwald. And it came out really fuzzy with my printer, and it's going to be tough to read, so bear with me. And it's in sort of Twitterese. It says, people gassing about the deaths of soldiers. What about the innocent families who've been brutally killed? The women who have been raped? The children who have been sliced up? Your enemy was the Taliban, not innocent, harmful families. I think he means innocent, harmless families. All soldiers should die and go to hell. The low-life fucking scum, that's the way he put it, got a problem. Go cry at your soldier's grave and wish him hell because that's where he's going. End quote. The following day, Greenwald says, Ahmed was arrested and, quote, charged with a racially aggravated public order offense, end quote. The police spokesman explained that, quote, he didn't make his point very well, and that's why he's landed himself in bother, end quote. The state proceeded to prosecute him, Greenwald writes, and in October of that year he was convicted, quote, of sending a grossly offensive communication, end quote, fined and sentenced to 240 hours of community service. Demonstrators on the street were demanding that he be imprisoned. Now, later on in the piece, Greenwald writes about a 22-year-old Iraqi-British woman who was arrested and charged with using Twitter to promote terrorism. The story says, quote, in the words of the police, she stands, quote, accused of providing a service that enabled others to obtain, read, listen to, or look at a terrorist publication by providing links to speeches and other propaganda, end quote. When she appeared in court last month, Greenwald writes, the prosecutor emphasized that she is, quote, accused of uploading 45,600 tweets in just under a year, encouraging children to use weapons and embrace extremism, end quote. Among her transgressions is, quote, posting pictures of corpses felled in battles, poems entitled Mother of the Martyrs. She faces years in prison, Greenwald says, and the judge has barred her from using Twitter pending her trial, end quote. He then goes on to talk about a 35-year-old mother of six in the UK who was sentenced to 5 years in prison for promoting terrorism on Facebook. That's in quotes. And the judge said that the accused had intended to radicalize others. That's a quote. Intended to radicalize others. Nazis on Twitter, right? Now, lest you think this is only a European thing, Greenwald's article goes on to talk about an American who had attracted police attention last month in Massachusetts after posting on his social media account the words that were posted by the guy who assassinated two police officers in New York since the last time we talked to you. It's been a long time. I'm sorry, folks, since the last show. Personal problems here, life intervening, my apologies. Nonetheless, there was that terrible assassination in New York, two police officers killed. The guy who did it had said on social media something about a phrase with, you know, putting wings on pigs or something. And this person posted, put wings on pigs, in quotation marks, with nothing else. And boom, got contacted by the police. Nothing's happened to him. And as Greenwald says, that's clearly free speech. But I wonder how many people feel it should be in this country. Once again, getting back to the question here, I mean, everybody in the wake of these terrible, terrible disasters says the right thing. We did after 9/11. The French are now in these wonderful protests that are great to see, and I'm completely behind the sympathies, right? Everybody loves to say those things. But that's in the heat of how we feel now, defending these broad concepts. It's much more difficult once we start talking about what those broad concepts entail. And they entail being willing to allow people to say this kind of stuff, for example, on the internet in a way that's scary, to basically transmit ideas that could hurt us. If you're for freedom of expression and freedom of speech, you can't just say, I'm only for freedom of speech if it doesn't hurt me. We all have different views of what that might be. Now, where are the limits of free speech? You know, there's an old court case in the United States where it was famously said that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You don't have the freedom of speech to do something like that. There are people who would suggest that the equivalent of lampooning the Prophet Muhammad is that. And that's an interesting point there, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, if you are someone who would be very offended by a satirical magazine in the United States portraying President Obama in a cartoon that makes him look like a 1930s step-and-fetch-it, you know, buckwheat racial stereotype, how are you going to feel about that? I have a feeling it's pretty similar to how the people who feel that it's intolerable to see the Prophet Muhammad lampooned that way, kind of how they feel. In other words, what we're dealing with here is a standard human emotion, and we're all somewhere on the scale, right? Dan Carlin's an extremist on this issue, so he's a one. The person who gets upset about the Redskins' name maybe is a three on the I get offended scale. The people that would boycott the American version of a magazine like this French one that was so edgy are like a five. And then the people that would kill somebody over the Prophet Muhammad being lampooned are a 10. Seems to me everything here is understandable, but the response that the people involved took. You know, we talk about terrorism a lot on this program. It gets old. It's, you know, I thought the other day if we were doing this podcast in the 1950s, we'd be talking about communism all the time. And I feel like we talk about terrorism all the time. But when you have this tragedy in France, for example, how do you not? And what's interesting, and it, once again, it shows you a bit of the psychology of the terrorists, you know, in your head, if you're an American, you get this idea that it can't be as traumatic as 9/11 was to us, because that's on such a larger scale. Thousands of people die. These enormous, iconic buildings fall. New York's cleaning up for, I mean, the story goes on and on and on. But, you know, it really doesn't have to be a scale like that to have the same kind of impact. The specific variables can come together in a way that hits you in vulnerable spots. In France's case, it hit them right where they live in terms of values, right? That's why all those people are out there marching, supporting free expression as a bedrock French value and saying things like, and holding signs that say, you know, we won't be afraid. We're not going to compromise who France is under pressure from terrorists. And the United States said the same things after 9/11, and I wholly support those things. In other words, killing these people in this one profession to particularly take aim, literally, at the freedom that the French enjoy, that struck a little chink in the armor. There was a terrorist plot, and I don't remember where this came out. I want to say, we've talked about it before, I want to say it came out of hard drives that had been seized after 9/11 during some of the initial moves into places like Afghanistan. And it had some of these, the ideas, I guess you could call it the brainstorming list for some of the people who wanted to launch terrorist attacks. And to see how devilishly, deviously, evilly clever they are, is to take note of how much the terrorists are focusing on the psychology of the people they're attacking as opposed to real damage. 9/11, the scale impacted the psychology, but so did this thing in France. One of the ideas on the list of this brainstorming list that the terrorists had, same kind of an idea. Not very many people die, but the impact is huge. The idea was for lone gunmen to go around and start shooting beloved celebrities. Let me think about that a minute. It's a weird psychological thing, but if Joe Smith in Albany, New York, is killed in a terrorist attack next week, you're going to be angry, and it's going to stick with you for a little while, but soon you'll forget about Joe Smith. You never knew Joe Smith. He's a statistic. But if they shoot your favorite country music star, that cute little actress who was very popular, the new Shirley Temple, they shoot her, shoot the old beloved sheriff who from the 1960s TV series, and why not shoot his son too from Happy Days? I mean, you shoot these people and four or five or six or seven of them die, and you're going to be sitting here going, let's put it this way, it upsets you on a very different psychological level than Joe Smith in Albany, New York, that you never knew. And the terrorists knew that and are looking for psychological weak points, right? And they're looking for chinks in the armor. We have a huge chink in the armor. We're defending the free and open exchange of ideas as a bedrock national principle of ours, and we're saying we will not be afraid. the right things right after these terror attacks, but we are afraid. And we're prosecuting people who are coming too near the line. You can't spread these ideas. And we've seen this movie before, folks. This is like the Red Scare all over again. You couldn't, you know, people were so scared of anybody spreading communist ideas back then. Same thing. You'll infect people. It's an intellectual contagion. Isn't that what we've always called it, right? You're scared that someone's going to spread that virus, that bad idea. What was it called on Bill Maher's show? They called Islam the mother lode of bad ideas. And so you're spreading these bad ideas is the way people look at it. The problem is of course, bad ideas is an eye of the beholder thing. You know, 200 years ago, the bad idea that people were worried about spreading in some places was the very idea the United States is based on and that France is defending right now, too, liberty. It was France, by the way, that was spreading these dangerous ideas. When Napoleon was conquering all of Europe, he was conquering Europe from a bunch of guys who couldn't stand the idea of people having liberty because they were mostly monarchs and aristocrats and those kind of people. They were about as afraid of the French coming into their countries because of their ideas as they were about having actual French people taking over their countries, because they thought they might be able to kick the French out at some point. But if they contaminate, you know, the subjects of these kings and dukes and emperors with these ideas from the French Revolution of liberty, well, that never goes away. That takes hold, and then it's an ideology, and then what are you supposed to do? Then you've got Nazis, or then you've got, you know, radical extremist Islamic folks. Because, folks, that's the thing in this war, right? You can kill every single person who's an extremist. You could put every single one of them in jail. You could drone them. It doesn't matter. You could send them out of your country. We have too many Islamic folks in our country. These are dangerous terror cells. We're going to send them all somewhere else. And then the next week, one of your blonde-haired, blue-eyed citizens decide he just heard about Islam, did a little reading, and you know what? He's a Muslim. He's been one all along. He didn't realize it, and now he's joining the faith. And oh, by the way, you know, where are all the other Muslim people? I mean, the problem with ideas, folks, is you're continually making new people who can be infected by the ideas, if they're bad. Now, let me explain the if they're bad part a little bit, because I've said for a long time that the people we talk about when we talk about Islamic extremism are a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of this enormous religion, Islam, right? And I got an email from somebody a little while ago, very nice, but trying to sort of explain a little different side to that thing. He says, yes, Dan, if we're specifically talking about the people who would launch terror attacks, strap bombs to themselves, shoot people in cartoonist offices or whatever, yes, it's a tiny little fraction of the population out there. But if you look at, say, public opinion polls, I think he said, and you find out how people answer some of the questions they're asked, the number of people, the percentage, let's say that, of people in the Islamic world who would say, for example, that the proper thing to do to someone who lampoons the Prophet is to kill them, is higher than we might like to imagine. I don't know what that number is, but I can see that. I think we've seen evidence of it somewhere. I want to get into that a little bit because, again, to me, if we're focusing on a problem here, and maybe from a new angle, I look at this as a spectrum sort of thing, the offensiveness spectrum. And as I said, I'm on one end, the Islamic terrorists are on the other. You know, people who would have a problem with this satirical newspaper maybe right in the middle. I want to talk about how you could perhaps take this very human response of being offended and drag it into the realm of what's considered an okay response in our society. And this involves looking at, I guess, a difference in what we just talked about there. Maybe these public opinion polls or whatever it was that showed that perhaps the folks being interviewed were a little harsher in terms of what they thought the proper response to offensiveness was. I thought about a thought experiment, and this was for myself, but I was just trying to imagine, and I thought about a church in the United States, any Christian denomination, say Catholic, Methodist, Baptist, or take a synagogue here in the United States, same thing. And imagine that the service is happening, and then at the end of the service, the congregation files out the main entrance or exit, And as they do, they run smack dab into somebody who has placed themselves in such a position so the entire congregation has to pass by and see what they're doing. And what they're doing is something horrible to the most sacred, you know, object of this religion. Fill in the blank, whatever that might be. So you come out of church and you look and there's this guy doing something terrible, you know, to something you venerate. Fill in what he's doing too. What do you think happens? And I thought about this. I thought, you know, there's probably three main reactions you could expect from the parishioners at that point. Now, this is the United States in this thought example. So we are a heavily armed country. And there are people in a situation like that. I think it would be human to expect a small percentage of them to just go off, pull out a gun, shoot this person. Don't know what that would be, but a tiny percentage. And yet, maybe this is key. If they do that, they're going to go to jail for it. They're certainly going to be in big trouble. Nobody's going to say, well, you know, that was the proper thing to do. Anybody should have done that. It was your duty to do that. And that might play into this too. I think most of the people at any of these services in this thought experiment of ours, I think most of these people might react physically. I think they might go up to this person who's doing horrible things to their sacred object and punch him in the nose, kick him in the stomach. I don't think that would be unexpected. I think that would be considered a relatively expected human response. And I think it would fall into the category, and Ben, I'm not up to speed on this. I don't know if this still counts, but there used to be something in American jurisprudence known as fighting words. You know, if one man walks up to another man and his wife and starts saying horrible things and calling his wife horrible names, and he punches that guy in the nose, and that goes to trial, you know, the lawyer may say, hey, fighting words. I mean, what was he supposed to do? Turn around and say, I've never been so insulted in all my life. I mean, any of us would have done it. That guy probably gets off if a jury even sees that case. Fighting words. But if that man pulls out a gun and shoots the guy who's saying rude things to his wife, well, you can't do that. The response is inappropriate, right? It was totally human to become offended in that situation. Most of us would. And punching him in the nose is something any of us could see happening, but shooting him is wrong. Goes over the line. But not everywhere. In that thought experiment of ours, imagine instead of an American church or synagogue that we're not in the United States, and it's a Muslim place of worship. And that same thing happens, and the congregation comes out the main entrance and sees that person doing that horrible thing to the Prophet Muhammad, something, you know, again, fill in the blank. What is the nastiest thing you can think of? What do you think the people who witness that outside the Muslim mosque do? Well, here's the thing. I think in all three religions, there's a decent chance you're going to get a segment of the people that are just going to be, they'll call the cops maybe and try to get something else to stop, but they'll say a prayer for the guy and forgive. These religions tend to do that. I also think you'd get some people, you know, with the punches in the noses and everything else, but I think you'd probably have a higher percentage of people who thought that what that person deserved right here and now is a good killing. Why? And answering that why question is key, because if you can get the response more in line with what we in the West consider the proper response, well, then we're just talking about people who are offended. I mean, if these people who attacked the French magazine's offices walked up and punched all 12 of those people in the nose instead of shooting them, we still have a crime on our hands, and we've got serial punching going around in France, but you don't need a war on terror to fix that. War on bloody noses sounds like it's a lot less harmful to our, you know, civil liberties, right? So how do you change that? So I thought about this, and in reading, you know, this is, talk about the most unscientific evidence in the world, so I'll quote that. Reading the responses of people who comment in the comment section after news stories on news websites is intriguing. Now, I don't think it's a representative sample. I think a certain person does that. Especially the kind of person that says something, you know, I mean, the horrible comments about how this is just integral to Islam were interesting. There are people with justifiable criticisms, and then there are those who want to turn the Middle East, for example, into glass. And then a few people sort of in between. The people who suggest that this is an Islamic thing, I think, are missing out on the humanness of it. And because of that, go after the wrong things in terms of finding solutions. I'll give you an example of what I mean and how this idea of walking up to some guy with his wife and saying horrible things about her prompts a reaction. Now, I said that shooting that guy is over the line and a response that our society doesn't allow, right? We would prosecute you for that. But I just finished Mike Tyson's autobiography, and he was writing about his upbringing, and he's from a really poor area of Brooklyn, and then, you know, he grew up in the 70s and then the 80s, and then he would come back to these neighborhoods also where he grew up in the 90s, and he ran with, I mean, he was in the mix. Everything that was going on, you know, crime, drugs, everything that was a part of the makeup of those communities that you were just born into, as Tyson tried to point out. I mean, this was life. This was what poor people in the inner city, you know, lived with, and you just became a certain way, and the values were a little bit different. And one of the values that Tyson talked about in the book, but that we all remember if you were alive during this era, not because we experienced it, but because it was common knowledge, there were stories in the news, people would get killed in these communities for disrespecting somebody else. They simply had to disrespect somebody for the penalty, the proper penalty, as seen by these folks in this, what would you call it, mini-culture, executing your opponent for that disrespectful attitude, statement, action, whatever, was the proper response. Which is the same thing that the people who think you should have people killed who lampoon the prophet. I'm offended. The proper pronouncement to that is death. Some people on these news websites would say it says right there in the Quran, you have to kill people who insult the prophet. Well, why are the people in Mike Tyson's neighborhood doing it? They're not Islamic. They're offended. They're disrespected. They're killing each other over that. Why do they do that? Well, before you start then, you know, I can see those same people maybe pivot on a dime and say, well, you know, the inner city's got all kinds of problems and legacy of slavery and, you know, maybe some racist black talk. I mean, you never know what to expect. But I would point out that it's not a black thing and it's not an urban thing. You know, one of my most favorite stories about United States history, because it's perverse, and it's perverse with, before you even, if you just say what happens, it's perverse. Don't even have to describe it. How many people in the listening audience know, and I know some of you do, that one of the most, arguably the most, founding father of the United States, Alexander Hamilton, do you know he was murdered by the vice president of the United States? And he was murdered for basically the same reasons that people in Mike Tyson's neighborhood might shoot each other, or basically the same reasons that, you know, some of these feuds in the Islamic nations, you know, go down. Alexander Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr, vice president of the United States, in a duel. Now, at this time, they were trying to stamp that kind of behavior out, and it was illegal. Nonetheless, very proper, law-abiding people did it, and they did it because their honor was insulted, or they were besmirched, or they were offended. In other words, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr both thought that the proper response to having something like that happen to you is to kill the other guy. And that, of course, it was fair because we let them have a pistol too, and they get to point at us at the same time. This isn't murder. This is satisfaction, right? I demand satisfaction, sir. Folks, when you examine these kinds of behaviors, you realize that this is a completely human response, too. As much a human response as getting offended in the first place, to kill somebody is a pretty darn human response, too. But it's way down there at the other end of the scale, you know, from where the West can function. I've been to countries where... That's still, by the way, the main idea. I went to one country where I was talking to another guy there, and he was explaining to me that if you offend a person, you know, in that country a certain way, that killing them is not seen out of line. So, I mean, this you could perhaps argue it's cultural or mini-cultural in some of these cases, but what we have going on here is something that's maybe changeable. And I know that because since the attack in France, there have been some interesting, you know, news stories about people in the Islamic world coming out and denouncing what happened in France the other day. And some of them are surprising. Was it Hamas, Ben, who came out and said that, you know, what they did is not Islamic? Iran said something similar. the leader of Egypt said something only a couple of days before the attack on France that's worth reading you a few lines from, and take what he says with a grain of salt, okay? It's interesting that two of the most quotable Islamic reform ideas that have come out over the last several years have been proposed by either absolute dictators or monarchs. Perhaps you could make a case that they're some of the few people that feel protected enough or safe enough to make comments like that when the penalty could be death. I mean, to try to be an Islamic reformer in some of these places openly, loudly, you know, and overtly is a little like trying to be an anti-mafia reformer in Palermo, Sicily. Your car might blow up, you might disappear. It's a dangerous job, and they've probably had quite a few people who, if they'd had decades of work under their belt by now, could be more of these voices of moderation in these areas. But sometimes these people disappear or get blown up along the way. But this may have more to do with cultural norms in some parts of the world than anything to do with Islam. In other words, if you took Islam out of the equation, imagine that this is this region where the biggest part of our Islamic extremist problems come from, and it's the 4th century, right? There is no Islam yet. Do they still think death is the right thing to do if they're offended? Doesn't have anything to do with Islam at that point, does it? It has to do with a cultural norm. One of the things that Western culture has supposedly done is evolved from a situation where we think you kill people when you're offended. Is it cultural superiority to suggest to other people that they should do that too? As you long-term listeners know, what's so frustrating to a freedom-loving person like yours truly is the way we fight this war on terror. Perhaps this is a little review, but for the people who haven't listened to me for very long, I'm a war gamer. I know many of you are war gamers. Many of you do similar kinds of things like playing bridge, for example, is a wonderful one. President Eisenhower used to do that to sort of prune your mind and your thought processes the way you would a bonsai tree and get you thinking always about tactics and strategies and backup plans and goals, you know, and how you'll respond to moves that the other side makes. One of the things that drives me crazy about the war on terror is not that there is a war on terror. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, I mean, if people attack you, you're in a war, right? But the way we're fighting it. If this was a game of bridge or a war game or anything like that, the first thing you'd be asking yourself, if you're a good player, is how do I win? And then that would be the overriding goal every step of the way. You do not win by playing defense. And almost everything we do, and when I say we, I mean the entire non-terrorist world, the entire way we fight this thing is defensive. Even stuff that looks like it's offense is in fact defense. I mean, you think, what do you mean, Dan? We're droning radicals all over the Middle East. We're attacking. We have troops on the ground and this and that and the other country stamping out radical things. We've knocked down all these terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. That's defensive, folks. Offense means going at the fountainhead that is, I mean, if you think about it like a fountain or a wellspring somewhere, they used to have a thing, and we've talked about it in a couple episodes, called a womb of nations. And this would be applied by, say, medieval folks or early 19th, 20th century historians who would talk about these wellsprings where human populations sprung from. You know, there was one in Central Asia where they just seemingly disgorged all these peoples, one right after another. You know, Scythians, Sarmatians, Turks, Huns, Mongols. I mean, they all, one right after another. And they said the same thing about Germanic peoples, too. You know, you end up with the people, you know, the barbarians that then encountered the Romans and then the Vikings and all these people who spring from the womb of nations. Now, those things are probably all fairy tales. But the concept when it comes to something that's like an intellectual contagion, I think is apt. If we think of our problem here as a wellspring of extremist ideas, if you will, we're attacking the rivulets that run down, you know, the side of it. Getting rid of training camps is simply getting rid of the results created by the bad idea. If the bad idea continues to create new results, you will be destroying terrorist training camps until the end of time. It's defense. Now, the reason that Americans and French folks and everyone else should be concerned about playing defense is that playing defense is bad for free societies. When you try to protect people, you ratchet down and harden the society. And it's natural. I mean, when you have 9/11 happen, for example, it's prudent, and everyone thinks so, to buckle down on things like the nuclear weapons and the nuclear, you know, power plants, right? That's just common sense. There are targets you should harden in your society. Those kinds of attacks always remind you, hey, you know, we may have been a little lax lately since the Soviet Union fell. Let's redouble our efforts in a couple of these important areas. The problem happens when that trickles down, good word for this, to the lower levels of society. When you have the Homeland Security Department and they establish their fusion centers right in your little local town and it's all connected like an octopus sort of web all the way to the top of the federal government's intelligence operations and they share information and it's just common sense we're trying to defend ourselves. Look what happened in France the other day, right? But it's horrible for freedom. And it's useless in its goal. You could perhaps have an argument if the hardening of our society, and remember, it hardens for terrorism, but it's hard for everything. That's why all these anti-terror laws are being used overwhelmingly against things that aren't terrorism. There's not that much terrorism, but there's a heck of a lot of other crimes, and the society doesn't unharden just because it's not terrorism. They don't sit there and take off the helmets and all the body armor and all that stuff the federal government, you know, gave to them as part of war on terror grants because they're going after a drug dealer. When the society hardens, it stays hardened. It's hardened for terrorism because we're playing defense. But you can't play defense. Terrorism's like water. It's why the tactic is popular. You harden airplanes, they go after trains. And when you think to yourself, we'll just cover everything, they shoot your celebrities. Right? You can harden the whole society, and how much, folks, have we spent? How much money have we spent? You know, when you talk about opportunity costs, what else could we have spent, you know, once you harden the common sense targets, what could we have used that money on in a more effective way to get to our goal in the war on terror, which is to win? Well, as I've said many times before on this program, you have to attack the idea. You have to go after that wellspring that continues to create new little worker ants that keep our forces busy killing them. I've said that for years. There was an interesting article, though, in my local paper, of all things, by a guy. I want to quote him a little bit because, you know, sometimes you can take Dan Carlin's kooky, insane idea and give it a good name, and it sounds totally legit all of a sudden. Why didn't I think of that? And by the way, before a million people write me, lots of people had this idea. If I ever get, like, the idea, you'll be the first to hear me proclaim it as my trademarked idea. I'll get a little sound that's like the trademark stamp, and every time I say it, you'll hear that. So if I don't say that, I probably don't own that idea. But to me, people who see this clearly, wouldn't I say that, understand that this is a war of ideas. And we are particularly vulnerable because we're a society, Western culture, that champions, you know, the open nature of our societies to ideas and even dangerous political ideas. Should the Nazis be on Twitter? This man's name, who wrote this article that appeared in my local paper, and that happened on January 8th, 2015. God, it's going to happen a few more times, folks, I'm warning you. January 8th, 2015, Ajit Mann, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in the Eugene Register Guard. He's identified in the paper as the author of Counterterrorism Narrative Strategies. Well, that's what we've been talking about for years. That's how you fight offense in a war of ideas, with counterterrorism narrative strategies. That's a great way to put it. So half of this article does not apply to what we're talking about here. He uses the torture question, which we talked about, was it the last show, Ben? Who can remember? He talks about that for a while as being something that conflicts, though, with what we keep trying to say, you know, we espouse in this country. So that becomes part of the problem when our ideals, as we tell them, you know, we're for free speech and free expression, and then if that paper in France decides to relocate to Houston, Texas, how are we going to handle those buckwheat-like portrayals of the president? This author kind of points out that, you know, our words aren't always matching our deeds. But then he says what we need to do to really fix the problem. He says, quote, "The United States urgently needs a counter-narrative to address extremist propaganda, and it should be delivered by a credible source. Unfortunately, both the narrative and the credible source have proven difficult to come by." He says, "Given recent and not so recent revelations, government sources may not be the most credible nor trustworthy messengers of an anti-terror narrative. The message might have a better reception if it comes from civilian ranks," he says. But then he says, quote, "Whoever takes on this battle, and wherever they come from, will have to come up with a strategy that directly attacks the narrative, not the ideological basis of extremism, with equal and opposite force," end quote. And he says the reason you do that is because if you attack it from an ideological basis, that takes time. He says narratives work immediately. He says a story will outpace the facts every time. And the effect of stories, he says, will last long after the facts are forgotten. Stories don't have to defend their premises. All they have to do is cause associations and provoke identification. He says communicating in times of urgency should take the form of storytelling and should enlist cognitive triggers. This variety of strategic communication is not a substitute for rational analysis and logical argument. It is the way to communicate the products of analysis and reason, particularly when there is an urgent and immediate need to affect behavior. Narratives change how power works. Whoever constructs the operative narrative holds power. As we are seeing, he writes, that makes narrative the perfect weapon for a less powerful actor. It is there, at the narrative level, that we must be confrontational. End quote. In other words, you know, fighting ideas with other ideas and behavior. This author's point is that, you know, the behavior has to match the ideals too. This isn't a propaganda war. But the point that's most important in this piece is the need for the new narrative or the counter narrative to come from a credible source. And this is where it's apparent that a place like the United States, as much as we like to see ourselves, and maybe France and the West, we like to see ourselves as the, you know, core enemy of Islamic extremism, have to accept the fact that we're not, that we are a sideshow, that this is not a war designed to do anything to us, even though Americans constantly say it is. This is a conflict for Islam. We have allies in this war. And those are the people who have any credibility with the people that are being recruited and who are vulnerable to the narrative that people like the Islamic State throw out there, the ISIS folks. It is only the Islamic folks who can eventually define what is Islam and what sort of teachings are outside the boundaries that become sects and cults and heretics. From the Islamic view. I mean, you need to hit these people on a motivational level where they live. The motivational level is God. You only hit the God level by somebody whom they trust telling them that that person they're listening to that says God wants them to go cut people's heads off is an idiot and a heretic and is not a true Muslim. If you say it, if the United States says it, if we start putting out World War II style propaganda videos saying that, we're the crusaders trying to teach Muslims about Islam. That doesn't work. And there are more people, as I said earlier, coming forward and who have more credibility than anything we might put forward. I mean, we mentioned the Amman message that the King of Jordan had put forward a couple years back. These are attempts to get together religious scholars and start to define, you know, what's okay and what's not. We may differ between ourselves, but what is mainstream Islam and what encompasses this? And I've said before, and didn't the president make some noise about this the other day, Ben? Was I reading it wrong? That, you know, if President Obama wanted to push this process forward in a way that Richard Nixon would term seizing the moment, he could call for some kind of summit. You know, these are the kind of things presidents still have power. People may argue the president really doesn't have the power to do this, Dan, or there are constraints where he can't do that. Yeah, but he can get up there and ask for stuff. He's got the bully pulpit. You could get up there and say, you know what? The United States would love to get behind a movement to meet in blank important Islamic City and bring together all the important scholars. And the way you frame this whole thing is you make it so that anyone who thinks they are anyone in the Islamic religious hierarchy wants to be there because it's a sign that they are someone. Only the people who are important get invited to the Queen's wedding. Only the people that really count in Islam get invited to this summit. And it would be especially good if the United States involved some of the thinkers that we can't stand. You have to do that to make it real. You got to include the people that think that killing people who are offended by the Prophet Muhammad's cartoons is the right thing to do. They have to be there too. And you get the ball rolling. Now, maybe everybody turns around, you know, gets into a huff with each other and walks out. But there's been some movement. I mean, where we sit now is to have these debates and nobody does anything. But the leader of Egypt, who let's understand is not only unelected, but who is responsible for overthrowing the people that were elected, which turned out to be the kind of people the United States would hope would never be elected. His name is al-Sisi, but he made some comments that even though they kind of fit what the United States would hope a Muslim leader would say, a little too closely to take at total face value, are still interesting. And conservative media in the United States has been on this story. This one's from the International Business Daily. It's an editorial that appeared on their website on the 5th of January, 2015, from the beginning of the piece. And by the way, the subheadline for this is Beginning of an Islamic Reformation. From the beginning, quote, "To many in the West, Islam seems mired in a pre-medieval mindset that makes it unable to reconcile the fundamental precepts of its faith with those of the modern world. But there are encouraging signs of change. In what Roger L. Simon rightly calls an extraordinary New Year's speech, the story says, that got virtually no attention in the West, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi issued a sweeping, no-holds-barred critique of Islam and suggested it needs major reform." This is al-Sisi talking now. Quote, "It's inconceivable that the thinking that we hold most sacred should cause the entire Islamic world to be a source of anxiety, danger, killing, and destruction for the rest of the world. Is it possible, he asked, that 1.6 billion Muslims should want to kill the rest of the world's inhabitants, that is 7 billion, so that they themselves may live?" End quote. He then said Islam needs a quote, end quote, religious revolution. Now, what's interesting, though, folks, is that there are a lot of people who are already on that side of the Islamic divide, if you will. Anyone who would have answered my question about coming out of the church and finding the, or mosque or synagogue and finding that person, you know, defiling your religious sacred object, anyone who would have thought that death was not the right answer to that is already on the right side of the divide, which to me includes most Muslim people in the world. I mean, if you know any Muslims, you say to yourself, well, those aren't the people I know. They're not people who would do anything like that. Of course not. And so when we talk about this war on Islamic extremism, as we said, it's a war between other people, and we're on one side. We're on the side of the Islamic folks who think it's crazy that the penalty for being offended, even if it's religious offensiveness, should be death. There's nothing wrong with feeling offended, but you need to be boycotting and protesting and writing your congressman and, you know, getting advertisers to stop advertising. In the Western modern world, that's how we do it. There's a lot of folks in Islam who think that's how you should do it too. And those are the people who need to come out victorious in this struggle to define what is permissible in Islam and what is heretical. And before you think that sounds too simplistic, let's remember we have a lot of problems coming to those conclusions, including that some of the people who are ostensibly on our side in this intellectual conflict have real sympathies for some of the ideas of the other side too. Maybe so many sympathies that they've given money and support to people who hold those ideas. We've got nations like the Saudis and Pakistan and places like that who are ostensibly on our side in this, but not all in. And the fact that they live their lives the way they do in their country causes some of the problems. I mean, there's a story, and you probably heard it, about the Saudis starting the carrying out of a sentence of an activist there, someone who was arrested and sentenced based on things that people in this country take for granted every single day and that people in France are marching for right now. He was sentenced to 50 lashes a week for 20 consecutive Fridays. So just as the wounds are starting to heal a little bit, you get hit with them again. This is the same country that beheaded 59 people, according to this story. That's the current number. And folks who not only think the right things maybe to do to thieves are to cut off their hands and to have this kind of a justice system, but who think that that's the idea that should spread to others. Remember, the Saudis are the principal proponents in the Muslim world of Wahhabism. And this idea of a more earlier, pure form of Islam, which involves going back to standards that were in vogue centuries and centuries ago. So is it any wonder that they conflict with norms we're trying to impose now? The problem with following books that are centuries or millennia old is that a lot has changed. When people say, this is all in the Quran, you can read every word of it, and that's why they're following it word for word, I always like to report back, well, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that we're not doing anymore. There's a lot of really harsh laws. Go look at Leviticus. Why aren't we living like that? We can kind of pick and choose what seems to be out of step with the modern world, can't we? Even the so-called fundamentalists in our country don't want to do those kind of things. So why can't Muslims fall into that same sort of situation? Well, many already have. What I answer to people who say, Dan, this is such a complex question. Islam is so diverse and so complex, and there's so much different too, and so many old feuds and all these kinds of things, and tribalism impacts it. And, you know, I always say we don't have to fix it, and we Americans don't have to understand it. We have to help the people that already want to fix it, fix it. I do wonder how much of the Muslim world would come out, including people even in these very hardcore reactionary areas where their version of Islam is very darn strict. I wonder how many of those people are captives, essentially, who if they thought they could come out and not get, you know, punished by the religious authorities or whomever is acting as religious enforcer, if they thought they could come out and speak freely with the First Amendment rights to free speech, I wonder how many of those people would say, you know what, I was never for this. This isn't what I think Islam is. I want an Islam in here that's more like the kind of Islam they practice in that other Islamic country. I wonder, there's no way to know that. But the point is that, you know, in this war on terror, I think we have to remember that we're an associate power, which is what the United States called itself in the First World War. We weren't allies with the Entente folks, Britain and France. We were an associated power, an associate power. That's what we are in the war on terror. Our job is to help the Islamic folks that are already on the right side of this war win. President Obama, if I'm remembering that right, and you would actually even thrown out the idea of calling some kind of a summit, well, I think that's a good start. That would be the first offensive move we've made in the war on terror that I can think of right now on the top of my head. And you know what? As a guy who thinks that playing defense in the war on terror is killing us and playing right into the hands of the people who are striking at us, I can't think of a more positive development than attacking. And in a war of ideas, that means taking on the bad ideas head to head, and especially using credible sources, as this author in my own local paper had said, to, you know, add a counter narrative to the discussion out there. And I think the reaction that you've seen from, was it Hamas or Iran or these other groups that you would expect to have come out on the other side of the issue to the killings in France, is a hopeful sign that we're starting to see the questions of what the proper reaction is to a given outrage begin to maybe pull back to levels in the direction of, I don't want to suggest that they're anywhere near where the West is, but in the direction that we want to see them going. The war on terror is a very depressing thing without a lot of silver linings. This is something that you could look at and say, that if those people dying in France, and there were more than just the 12 in the newspaper. There were people taken hostage. I mean, it was more than a day long affair. If those people's deaths end up prompting more people in the Islamic world who have some clout to come out and publicly declare that that wasn't okay, maybe there's a silver lining to the horrific carnage that occurred a couple of days ago in France. We can only hope. We've told you about Ting before, and every time I'm about to read, you know, one of their sponsorships here, I try to think about different aspects of what they do that I really like. I love the idea of no contracts because it changes the entire rest of the relationship. That's what I would think Ting is most famous for, especially when we started running these ads. It was so unusual to have a cell phone company that didn't sign you up to a deal that you had to pay money if you wanted to leave early, right? Changes the whole relationship because once those companies stick you, they got you. They don't have the same incentive to keep you happy on a day-to-day basis as someone that's got no contract with you, whose service is based on one thing. You like it today, so you're staying. If you don't like it tomorrow, you're leaving. It's Ting's job to keep you happy, and that's why they've designed the service the way they have. We've told you about it before, right? Start with the basic idea that you only pay for what you use. You can have a plan with them that ranges from the extra small to the extra extra large, but it's not that big a deal, because if you use more than you planned, you have a heavy month with Ting, doesn't matter, you just pay for what you use. They're not going to ding you with any special fee. Get your text messages, your voice minutes, your megabytes for data. It's all billed separately, all broken down, easy to understand. No overage charges or penalties. No add-on charges. Everything like voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspots, it's all included. You can have unlimited devices on one plan. Excellent customer support. All this stuff has to be there because you're not tethered to them. You don't like them, you're gone. They know it. They've designed the service around it. I think that's pretty cool. If you go to dancarlin.ting.com right now, you can save $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up.
Do you shop online at Amazon.com? If you do, consider doing so through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com. Your shopping experience will be the same as always, but Amazon will give Dan and Ben a little kickback for sending you there.
Hi, this is Bill. Dan doesn't have time to solicit, so I will. I'm the panhandler of podcasting. Would you make a donation, please?
If not, we're going to send somebody to your house. You better protect your kneecaps. Thank yous all very much.